Washi Tech.
Hey, it's Joe, and I don't have to tell you, relationships are critical in Washington. But how do you A, find out who the key players are, and B, figure out how to reach out to them? Well, I want to tell you about Leadership Connect. It's been an absolute lifesaver for us as we expand our operations and outreach here at Washing Tech. Leadership Connect, it's the digital service used by top federal contractors and government affairs leaders to contact decision makers and develop those strategic relationships. Visit leadershipconnect.io and join the community. I love it, and I'm 100% sure you will too. That's leadershipconnect.io. Try it now.
The first most obvious example involves misinformation that comes directly from the White House or from the president. It's unfortunate that office is a source, such an important source of misinformation.
Welcome to the Washington Tech Policy Podcast.
From Washington, D.C.
with Joe Miller.
Hey,
everybody. We've got a big antitrust hearing Wednesday with CEOs of Facebook, Google, Apple, and Amazon set to appear before the House Antitrust Committee. 12 p.m. sharp in 2141 Rayburn. The law of antitrust and competition, of course, has developed in somewhat of a colorblind way, with few, if any, cases focused specifically on what happens in the marketplace when firms commit racial discrimination. How does it affect product quality and consumer choice? You like this music, right? It's where I wish I were. The development of antitrust law developed in the late 19th century to break up Standard Oil. This, of course, was also the Jim Crow era, and so the framework never included an assessment of how market behaviors affect consumers of color specifically. It was just sort of presumed back then that all of the legitimate consumers were white. And so civil rights never entered into the discussion, and the law evolved that way, talking about vertical integration, horizontal integration, monopsony power, and all these technical terms, but never considering that people of color buy products and services, and that sometimes, just sometimes, when these firms behave in discriminatory ways, that they may have a unique impact on our communities. Well, now's the time. Never before has the impact of racialized propaganda taken on such an outsized role in discussions which traditionally don't include race as a component. But of course, you'll have all those white shoe lawyers pushing back and saying, well, you're not an antitrust expert. Well, maybe that's a good thing, right? Because a lot of law firms representing tech companies have diversity problems of their own. So, you know, not the most credible people in the world, but that's what we've got. We'll see how it plays out. My guest today is Philip Howard, director of the Oxford Internet Institute and a statutory professor of internet studies at Balliol College at the University of Oxford. He investigates the impact of digital media on political language around the world, and he's a frequent commentator on global media and political affairs. He's the author of 9 books, 140 academic papers, and his recent book entitled Lie Machines, How to Save Democracy from Troll Armies, Deceitful Robots, Junk News Operations, and Political Operatives was published in May, Yale University Press, London. Please welcome Phil Howard. Philip, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
So tell us how you define lie machines.
A lie machine is a combination of the social and the technical. It involves an organization of people who put out misinformation. And then there's the technical side of things, the social media algorithms that deliver those political lies into your social media feeds.
And so how do platforms play a role in political outcomes? I know we saw Cambridge Analytica, of course, has become the classic example. How have you seen things change since then? Since 2016,
the techniques have become even more sophisticated. One of the big surprises from 2016 is the degree to which political campaign managers and social media platforms do these A/B testing on ads to very rapidly, with thousands of people, figure out which kinds of faces, which kinds of voices, which kinds of keywords are most likely to activate people. And the science behind that has gotten better and better over time.
Yeah, I often see that just running a platform. You see MailChimp suggesting ways to implement A-B testing. And, you know, it's a very simple way that they describe it for small businesses. But, you know, they never mention that there are all these sophisticated algorithms that large businesses can use to really find out at a deep psychographic level how people make decisions based on the content they see.
Absolutely. And the important point is that these tools are not just for businesses. They're for politicians or foreign governments as well. I guess we've just been surprised that politicians are actually using the very same tools to market themselves and market themselves directly to us.
And so what are you seeing when we drill down to specific examples of politicians using lie machines and lie algorithms and the entire ecosystem that you describe here? How are they using it?
Well, it tends to be about attacking opponents. These days, there's a lot of misinformation around COVID, around the coronavirus crisis, and it sort of depends on which political actor you're talking about. Foreign governments, so China, Russia, they're eager to shape what we think about as the cause of the crisis, and they want people in democracies to think their democracies are weak and not going to respond well, and that Russia and China have done the hard work of the science and getting the virus under control. Domestically, there's all sorts of political actors that use the very same toolkit to try to spread misinformation about politics or public health. The first most obvious example involves misinformation that comes directly from the White House or from the president. It's unfortunate that office is a source, such an important source of misinformation about what's going on, but it is, and that stuff, ideas on misinformation about how to cure or avoid or what kinds of risks to take, that stuff travels far on social media. Now, foreign governments tend to be most interested in undermining our democratic values. They tend to they publish stories about how they're leading the science. They're going to get to a cure first. They tend to publish articles about how they're sending democracies aid, about how they send masks and ventilators to Washington, D.C. and London and Northern Italy. So there's a lot of PR that goes behind some of these, a lot of PR messaging strategy that goes behind some of these campaigns.
That's disturbing. The instability that we have in the U.S., both caused by magnified by some of these activities that are happening by both our own elected officials and then foreign governments who support them and any number of bad actors that support them, and using our agencies and the White House as media platforms. And, I just hope that, we avoid a situation where we have the judiciary becoming more and more of a media platform as opposed to what it was intended
right,
to be.
Or a target. I think over many countries now and several years of study, I think it's safe to say that the kinds of actors that use these techniques the most tend to be ultra-conservative, far-right, extremist rights, and I don't mean sort of mainstream Republicans, I mean, or mainstream conservatives. These are the white nationalists and radical conservatives who are most likely to pay big money to use these tools to target other conservatives or the general population with misinformation. There's a very little bit of it that happens on the left, but it's negligible. Most of the application of this stuff comes from far-right domestic actors.
Right, it seems much more egregious to engage in activities that are specifically designed to do these things as opposed to just some general claim of an anti-conservative bias. That's just sort of an outcome of the viewpoints of people who are on the air as opposed to a tactical strategy to create political outcomes. We're going to take a quick break here. When we come back, we'll learn more about your new book and some of the other implications of lie machines. Stay with us.
Tech policy is global policy. This is the Washing Tech. Tech Policy Podcast, serving the world.
Propaganda sort of evolved here and taken shape as a result of these platforms?
Well, the classic way of portraying protests, especially Black Lives Matter protests, is involves painting them as about riots or looting or violence or urban decay. And that's something that both foreign governments do and some domestic actors will do. So that clearly governors or mayors can't manage their cities. They're not providing the resources needed to take care of people. And these are just criminals or looters. And in fairness, it's not just Black Lives Matter. The Chinese government will say this about democracy advocates in Hong Kong, too. Right? The democracy and advocates in Hong Kong are just looters. They're criminal gangs. They're thugs. There's no real social movement there. And I think that's an offhand way of dismissing social movements, but it's something that dictatorships do, and it's something that far right political actors do domestically.
And to some extent, I've been thinking about how the Trump administration claims that they may block TikTok here in the U.S., but to a certain extent, given the control that the Chinese government has over corporations based in China, perhaps it could be, actually TikTok could be useful to the Trump administration to learn about how authoritarian regimes use social media to control messages.
Well, my editorial comment there is that I wouldn't want the Trump administration to be learning more about how authoritarian regimes use social media to control messages. I think you're right. It would be I understand your instinct, right? Getting to know these platforms might help us reach people in those countries with messages about the advantages of democracy. I'd say that one of the ironies here is that when the Chinese government or the Russian government puts information out in English targeted at voters in the West, they often use social media platforms that aren't actually allowed in their own countries, right? So Twitter is not a useful tool within China, but it seems to be a good propaganda tool for reaching voters outside China. Same is true for Facebook. These are highly restricted platforms domestically, but those governments use them to communicate with us, with our citizens regularly.
Interesting topics here, and the question is, especially with the antitrust hearing that's coming up in Congress here in the U.S. with the CEOs, these are important questions that we're going to need to focus on.
I think there are some things we can do, right? It's not quite too late to change. I think, in a very fundamental way, the best data about public life and public problems isn't available to the public, right? So we know that there are disparities in race, gender, and social inequalities of several different kinds, but the best information of that, about that, isn't sitting with the Library of Congress or the British Library or the Bodleian Library. It's sitting in private hands in Silicon Valley, and it's sitting with those firms that are coming up to Congress. So, you know, I don't have, of the particular policy agenda I would have, I would say it's time to look for ways to share data, to protect anonymity, right? Keep private records confidential. But investigative journalists and researchers, medical researchers, we need access to this flow of data that, for the most part, now just goes to private firms to sell for their commercial, you know, for ad placement. Many of us, if we could, would share our health data with medical researchers if it would help get a handle on the COVID crisis, but we actually don't even have the ability to do that with the tools that we have.
What are some final ideas you'd like to leave with us before we close?
Well, I'm director of the Oxford Internet Institute, so you can do a search and find me at the Oxford Internet Institute at Oxford University. I think the last thing I'd like to leave you with is this idea that we're not done yet. The internet can change, and we don't have to live with this social media system that we have now. I think there's several policy ideas for breaking up the social media firms, encouraging diversity. There's proposals in several democracies around the world to actually tax and direct some of the revenue that social media firms raise back into independent journalism. Clearly, journalism needs a new business model, and social media platforms could be part of that new business model. So there's a bunch of options we could seriously consider for how to fix this flow of data that seems to be benefiting just a few firms.
Philip Howard, director of the Oxford Internet Institute, author of the new book entitled Lie Machines, How to Save Democracy from Troll Armies, Deceitful Robots, Junk News Operations, and Political Operatives. Dr. Howard, thanks for joining me.
Thanks for having me.
And that concludes episode 239 of the podcast. Thanks so much for listening. If you like what we do here, we'd love to hear from you. Please leave a rating and review in Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen to podcasts. Helps others know what they can expect from the show and really helps us out. Thanks for listening, and I'll see you back here next week. Take care.
Washing Tech.